My name's Joe Hugh. I guess a few months ago when we were trying to decide on who to get in here for a speaker, we listened to a number of tapes and talked about different speakers and came up with the idea of asking Chink. And so I called her in Oklahoma City and I got her answering machine and it went something like this. If you want to talk to Ed, you've got 10 seconds. If you want to talk to Chink, you got an hour and a half. We got the right speaker. She's very witty, and she has a very good story to tell. And so now I introduce to you Chink A. from Oklahoma City.
Hi, everyone. My name is Chink, and I'm a very grateful member of this worldwide fellowship called Al-Anon. And I've got some notes here that I want to talk about before I start saying something. That'll get to you in a minute. Joe and I have talked with each other on the phone quite a bit, and the last time I called him, I got his answering service. And then he called me back, and I said, where were you? And he said, I was in the pen. And I said, you was where? And he said, in the pen. And so I let that go. And and when I hung up, I said, that's strange. And Eddie said, what? And I said, well, he said he just got out of the pen. And Eddie said, well, he's probably carrying a message to down the penitentiary. And, our Al-Anon way of thinking. And I had all these ideas, which I shouldn't have. But I'm very grateful to be here today. And I've got so many people that I want to thank. And when you get as old as I am, all the cells don't work anymore, anywhere. And I've just got one going up here. And so I just want to say that I want to thank everybody that had anything to do with inviting me down for this Heritage Day. And you've given me a lot of ideas to take back to Oklahoma, to our Al-Anon Information Service, and good ideas. And I did go and visit there this morning and went through the archives. And you've got a beautiful thing going. I want to thank Jean and Janet for sharing their home with me last night. And Clara and Joe met me out the airport. I can't remember everybody's name, and I'm going to leave it there because I thank you, and you know who you are. I'm going to say something right off. I do not intend to offend anyone with anything that I say. But when I tell how it was, I tell how it was. And it wasn't, honey, will you get up? You know, I say it like it was, and I tell what happened and the way it is now. I use words that might offend someone, and I hope not, but that's the way I was when I was in the throes of alcoholism. I'm just supposed to share my experience, strength, and hope, and that's all I've got. And I have a sponsor, and she said, you get up and you just tell it like it was. And she said, after all, you're the one that knows your story. And I felt good about that. I know today that because I married an alcoholic, that it doesn't make me an Al-Anon. I know today that because I go to a lot of Al-Anon meetings, it doesn't make me an Al-Anon. Because you see, when I came in, they told me there were certain things that I had to do, and I wasn't for sure that I was going to do any of them. Because I tell you, I hadn't planned to stick around long. I was looking for one word, and that was sobriety for that alcoholic, and then we'd get on with our lives. I had one of my friends said, well, you should tell them about how long you've been in, and I said, it really doesn't matter how long I've been in, because I said, it just means that I'll have to tell you that now, because I started all off wrong anyway. But I have been in 24 years. And the only reason that I say that is because if I quit now, I've got so much more to lose than some of those that have just come in. I mean, I have got so much more to lose. I found a new way of living when I came into Al-Anon. I didn't get it right off because they told me there were some things that I'd have to do. They told me that I'd have to have a contact with a God of my understanding, you know, of a morning when I first got up. And the God that I knew then, I didn't want anything to do with, so I just marked that out. And they told me that I'd have to work the 12 steps, and I didn't think that I was going to be here long enough, and I wasn't going to work those 12 steps. And they told me that I'd thank God at night, whether I'd had a good day or a bad day, and I did not want anything to do with that God. I want to tell y'all something before I get into this, into my experience, strength, and hope. I have a husband, and I think the taper here knows him, and he tapes for conferences. I'm going to tell you that he's 6'1", because I want y'all to know how I suffered. And he will not fly. And so when he was drinking, he had to go to Chicago quite a bit. And I'd take him out to the airport, and I'd always tell him, hey, don't be scared. You know, just trust in God. And I'd never been on an airplane in my life. So he looked like death warmed over, and he didn't like it, and he'd go. And when he come back, he was so happy that his feet were on the ground again. Now, I did not know I was going to get into a program, and I certainly didn't know that I was going to be sharing different places. And I'm not a speaker, but I said, if God thinks that I can go somewhere and carry a message and just help one person, then I'll go. Because I get so much more out of it than what I give. But my husband, for the first time that I was invited to go, was Jackson, Mississippi. And so I said, Eddie, I'm going to have to fly to Dallas and go to Jackson. And he said, I'll take you out the airport. And now he will not fly. He just does not fly unless he absolutely has to. And so he takes me out to the airport. And he said, what I'm going to do is in the morning I'm going to get up and I'm going to fix your breakfast. And I'm going to take your suitcase and put it in the back of the car, and we'll drive you out to the airport. I'm going to park. I'm going to take you in. We'll drink a cup of coffee. That big T-Bird will come in. I'm going to take your suitcase and put your suitcase on the airplane. And he said, and then I'm going to reach over, and I'm going to kiss your sweet ass goodbye, because I ain't going. I want to tell you that I am an only child, and that I was born and raised in a small town in East Texas. And I ran into some girl here that was born in the same town that I was. And it's a small town. And I didn't know what booze was. My mother and daddy didn't drink, and I was never around it until I got into high school. And when I got into high school and started running around with discovered boys, and started running around with different crowds of kids and everything. The one that I took to, and the one that I really liked the most, because he was more fun than anybody, was one that drank. And I had more problems with that guy, because my mother knew that he was from a family that drank. And she said, you are not going with him. I learned to lie real quick, because I was determined to go with that boy. And I would do that, and then I'd be grounded for maybe a week. Because, see, my mother was the one that disciplined me. When I was little, I knew that God was somebody special. Because mother took me to church, and she'd make me little dresses, and she'd fix me up, you know, real dainty, and the way we'd go. And I was so proud of me. And I'd go in, and on birthdays, we'd have the little pennies, and we'd drop the pennies in those little birthday things, you know, and they'd sing happy birthday and Jesus loves me and all this, you know, and I knew that God was somebody special. But then when I got up into the youth department, they was telling me something about if you do this, if you do that, if you do this, you're going to die, you'll go to hellfire. I was in a hellfire and brimstone church, and I was scared to death of that God. And I did not want anything to do with him. Now, my mother was the one that disciplined me all the time, and I didn't like her. I mean, as I grew up, I just got further and further away from her. Seemed like I'd try to get her approval, and I never could get it. There was a jealousy between my mother and me for my daddy's attention. Because, see, when I was born, I was the apple of my daddy's eye. I mean, I could crook him around my little finger, and I could get anything I wanted out of that man. And I loved him. When I was little, I thought he was God. He was good-looking. He was gray-haired. He always loved me. I sat in his lap. I could get anything I wanted. And it didn't change. I love my daddy dearly. Now, when I got into high school, I remember one time that my mother and I were arguing about something. I don't remember what it was. But I remember telling her, I said, "Mother, you know, if somebody comes by and I think that we can have a home and be happy, I'm going to marry that guy." And she said, "No, you're not. You're going to go to school. You're going to go to college." And I said, "What I'm going to do when I become 18, I'm going to get married." So I finished high school, and there was a boy came down from Kansas City. And I went with him for 6 months, and he was fixing to go back to Kansas City. And he asked me to marry him, and I said yes. And we went to Hugo, Oklahoma, and we got married. Now, when the minister said he pronounced us man and wife, my first thought was, "My God, what have you done?" Because, you see, I didn't love this boy. I married to get away from my mother. I wanted out from under. My mother disciplined me, and I did not like discipline. We moved to Kansas City and lived up there about six or seven months. And then we moved to another little town outside of Kansas City. Now, I was going to show my mother that I could have a happy home and be a good wife. But all this time, I had the guilt there that I didn't love this man. It wasn't right. But how was I going to get out? So I got thinking about my uncle that lived at Norman, Oklahoma. And I decided I'll go to Norman, Oklahoma. My uncle cares about me, and I wrote him a letter, and he said to come on, and so I left Ray and went to Norman. Now, this was during World War II, and I decided to get me a job there, and so I got a job out the South Base at Norman, and that was a naval base at that time. And I worked out there, and I got the divorce from Ray, and another man came into my life. And this boy had just gotten out of the service. And at first we went together and we had fun, just like normal couples do. But you know, there was something about him that attracted me because he was kind and he was gentle. And he cared about me. And he respected me and he treated me like a lady. And I went with this boy for 4 years. And I made plans to get married. I forgot to tell him. And I had what they call a hope chest, and we had gotten silverware and we'd gotten all this stuff together, and you know, everything was going just fine. I just thought, you know, now I'm going to be happy. And one night he came up to the house and we were sitting in the car talking, and he said, "Chink," he said, "I've got something to tell you." And I said, what is it?" And he said, "I don't think I'll be back." And I didn't think I heard him right. And I said, "What do you mean you don't think you'll be back?" And he said, "I don't know how to tell you, but," he said, "I just think it's best if we break up." Now, I want to tell you something. I mean, I was crushed because I had fallen in love with this guy, and I dearly loved him with everything I had. And I couldn't believe what I was hearing. So I went in the house, and he left, and I remember laying down on the bed, and I remember crying, and I remember saying, "God, I don't believe you're even up there. I don't think you give a damn about me." And that's the way I felt right then. I thought, you know, I don't know that there is a God, because I haven't done all this stuff that some of the others have, and what's causing me to have such a life the way it's going? And I remember going to work the next day, and it was just like in a trance. They asked me what was wrong, and I said, "I don't know. You know, I didn't want to talk. I didn't want to be around anybody or have anything to do with anyone." And I did that off and on, just month after month. I did not go anywhere. I lost weight because, I mean, I had lost the man that I really cared about, and I knew we would have had a good home. One of my friends that had formerly lived there in the same apartment house that I did had gotten married, and she called me one day and she said, "I want you to come over and have dinner with us." And I said, "Mary Jane, I don't want to go. I said, I just want to work and come back home. I said, I can't explain it. I'm down." And she said, "That's it. You need to get out." And I wouldn't go. And she said, "I'm going to keep after you until you do." And so on a Friday, she called me again, and she said, will you come over tonight? And so to get her off my back, I thought, well, you know, I'll go. So I go over there, and I had on a pair of shorts. I had no makeup on, and I was sitting there reading the paper. And there was a man came into the house. He just opened the door and walked in. And he was real tall. He had real pretty blue eyes. And he looked at me, and I looked at him. And I knew right then that I was willing to go to any lengths to get what he had. Eddie and I've laughed about that. He said, you know, he said, you hit me kind of hard too. And that night we played cards, and then he took me home, and we started going together. Well, right off, I told him, I said, Eddie, I want to tell you something. I said, I have had a relationship. And I know today that the reason that relationship didn't work for me was because I didn't have God in it. And when I hear these young kids saying, I've got this relationship going, I just say a little prayer for them because I think you better get it right, because it didn't work for me. And it really upset me. And so anyway, I told Eddie, I said, I'm going to tell you something. I said, I want to get married. And if you don't have that in your mind, I said, then I'm going to move on. So that's the way I proposed to him, and he accepted, and we got married in 1950. And I am still married to the same guy today, and we'll have 42 years in May. And I think that's a pretty good average this day and age. The first year that Annie and I was married, we had a lot of things happen to us. My father, that I was so close to, died of a heart attack. And you know, each time something would happen to me like that, I resented God. Because the first thing when they called and told me that my daddy had died, my first thought was, why did it have to be my daddy? Do you follow me? Why does it have to be my daddy? The only man that I really love, and you take him away from me. And I didn't want anything to do with God. Thank you, I can do it myself. A little later, we had a chance to get custody of Eddie's little boy, who was 3 years old. And we went to court on December the 24th, and we got full custody of this little boy. And I became an instant mother and knew nothing about being a mother. We had, at that time, we were looking for a home, a new home, and we found one. Now we have a little boy, and we've got a new home, and we buy a new car, and then Eddie wants me to have a new car, and then we've got new furniture, and then we've got a lot of new bills. And we're so busy making each other happy, trying to prove to each other, you know, how much we love each other and what all we're doing. And we sat down at the end of the month, and we're trying to figure out our bills. And sometimes our bills come out right on the dot. Sometimes we're way under. And then a little bit of friction started coming in there. And Eddie started saying to me, you know, if you didn't spend so much money on clothes, and I'd come back at him and say, well, if you didn't drink so much beer, and we were accusing each other. And it got a little bit rough around there, but then it simmered down. Now, after my father died, my mother was down in Texas, and we found ourselves going back and forth about 350 miles every other week. So we decided to move mother up there with us. And that was one thing that I regretted, because I took her away from all of her friends down in this little town that she'd lived in all of her life. But I had it my way. I'm going to have it my way. So I moved her up here to the city with us. And I found myself right back in the same situation that I was when I was in a little girl. There was my mother and me and Eddie this time. And my mother and Eddie got along real well. They fished together, and they understood each other, and they communicated. And here I'm sitting out there getting mad and angry, and they don't care about me, and what have I done? And I took a lot of my anger out on that little boy. And I didn't know that I was going to get into a program where I was going to make amends. But Bob and I got along pretty well. And when he was in high school especially, you know, because that was really in the throes of alcoholism then. And but with mother up there, and our home is not a big home, and we were a little bit crowded, and I said some very unkind things to my mother because I had a temper that I could not control. I didn't try to control it. I said words and things that I, at that time, meant. And I know today that it's not necessary for me to use that kind of language. Eddie and I lost communication because he would come home, and he's an easygoing person, and he wouldn't argue with me. Rather than argue, he'd just come in and sit down and maybe eat a bite and then go out in the garage because he's a ham operator, and I guess it was much more fun to sit out there and talk with a ham radio operators than it was to be in the house with some woman that's fussing 24 hours a day. Because, see, I had out things that we had to do to keep that house going straight. You know, Bob was to do this, Ed was to do that, and I ran the show. I knew that Eddie drank beer. He drank beer when I met him, and we partied together. We went dances together, and I could take one drink and sip on it all evening because, I mean, I have as much fun with a Coke as I could with a drink. It never appealed to me. But Eddie and I lost communication along the way, and it got worse. I didn't know that alcoholism was a progressive illness. I didn't realize that both of us were going down physically, mentally, and spiritually. But this was an everyday thing. As soon as he got home from work, he was in there a few minutes, then he'd go out in the garage. We have two little steps that go from the garage into the kitchen. And I would watch Eddie every now and then. We'd be doing something, you know, he'd be out there and I'd be in the living room. And he'd come in to go to bed, and every now and then he'd miss that top step. And I'd think, poor baby, he's so tired. And I really thought he was. I just thought he was just exhausted, you know, and I got to feeling sorry for him. And he'd come in and sit down in the recliner and lay back in that, and in a few minutes he'd be asleep. And I'd try to talk to him, and you know, we all know can't stand rejection. And I'd shake him because I wanted him to hear what I had to say. And then he'd, and then he'd go back to sleep. So I got to thinking, I don't think beer could make him do that. You know, I'm not too familiar with whiskey or anything, but I don't believe beer could do it that way, just a six pack. And so, you know, they tell me that when you start looking for trouble, you're gonna find it. And so I go out into the garage one night after he'd come in and gone to bed. And he had all this equipment out there, and so I didn't see anything except a beer can in the garbage or something, but I started reaching over behind like this. And lo and behold, I come up on a bottle neck, and I pulled it up, and here was a big fifth of Windsor Canadian, empty. Now I thought, I didn't see him bring that in. So I go on a little bit further, and I hit another one, and I pull it up. And my dandruff's up. Where did he start? When did he start drinking, and when did he bring that in that I didn't see him? And so then I decided to see how much more I could find because I've absolutely lost all control. And I go through that whole place, and I found bottle after bottle after bottle. And I got angry, and I threw those bottles all over that garage. I mean, I hit them from everywhere. I absolutely went crazy. And I thought, I'll let you see that you're not hiding anything from me. Well, the next morning, I couldn't stand it. I had to tell him. I said, Eddie, if you're going to drink whiskey, then bring the bottles in. Damn it, don't hide from me because I found them last night. And he said, okay. He's an easygoing guy. He said, I will. So he goes out and he brings in two fifths of Windsor Canadian. And he said, where do you want me to put them? Didn't go like I wanted to, but I said, well, put it above the refrigerator. Now, the refrigerator's about 6 foot tall. And that was hard on me because I have to get a little three-step ladder to get up there to mark the bottles to make sure, see how much he drank each night. And I don't know why to this day that I did that. But that was a ritual for me to climb those steps, get up, mark the bottles. And I knew what it was going to be the next morning. It'd be just about that much in the bottles. So I told him, I said, Eddie, you know, I think that what you're doing, you're starting out to drink too much and we're headed for serious trouble. And I think that you need to stop. And Eddie said to me, I can stop anytime I want to. And I believed him. And I said, okay. I said, then you better start. And so a couple of days he could do without it. And then I got to watching his eyes again. And then he'd go to sleep in the recliner. And I'd go over and I said, many a time I've opened the eyelids up, but there wasn't nobody home. I just looked in, and there wasn't nothing there. It was just blank. And I thought, you know, he's into drinking, and it's got to be stopped. I don't know if any of y'all have ever sat on the arm of your husband's chair and cried and say, you know, why don't we do something to get you to stop drinking? But I've done that night after night after night. Get on that arm of that chair and say, Eddie, please don't drink, because you're going to wreck our home. And he'd say, I know what's going on, and I'll stop. And I think that he really meant that he wanted to stop, but the thoughts of that bottle being gone was more than he could handle. And so that didn't work, and so I decided, well, you know what I'm going to do? I'll take it upon myself, and I'm going to really stop this mess, because I'd go to work. And they say we can't keep our mind on anything. I kept my mind on him 24 hours a day. From the time I went to work, I don't know how. I worked at the Baptist Hospital, and I don't know today how I could stand there and talk to these people in a civil tongue and take their money and give them their receipts and everything, and yet my mind was on him. So I told him, I said, Eddie, you know, I come in and I want to talk to you and I want to share things with you, and you just tune me out. If that's what you want, then buddy, that's what you'll get. And I said, for 1 week, I'm not going to talk to you. I said, I don't want anything to do with you. We passed each other in the hall, we'd go just like that. And I said, I don't want nothing to do with you. I want you to see how it is to live with somebody that's like a zombie. And so that was fine with him. I said, I'm not going to talk with you. Nothing. I mean, he just passed me in the hall and smiled. Now, in the back, this is so crazy, but I had a little pencil and paper, and I would write on Monday things that he said or did that I didn't think was right, and I'd write down. And I did this Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. We sat down and talked. I talked to him, tell him what he had done. And he'd sit there, and I said, do you remember this? And he'd say, yes. And it didn't mean a thing. He went right on drinking. I was in a hospital one time, and I went into the emergency room, and a little boy was in there upchucking, and he was so sick. And I asked the nurse, I said, what's wrong with that child? And he said, he took overdose of aspirin. And I said, but what's making him throw up like that? And she said, well, we gave him Ipecac, and the light came on. If I can get some of that, he'll stop drinking. So I went and asked the nurse if she'd give me some Ipecac for my grandchildren, which I didn't have. And she gave me a tall bottle, and I took off at 2 o'clock that afternoon and went home. Climbed up my little ladder, got my little whiskey bottle down, and poured out the whole bottle of whiskey, and poured the whole bottle of Ipecac in, because I thought if a teaspoon did that little boy, an 86-foot tall, this is my sick thinking, if he's 6 foot tall, he's gonna need a lot of it. So I poured the whole bottle in, shook it up, and it just blended perfect. I could not wait for Eddie to get home. He came in, and I said, honey, it's hot, why don't you go get you a drink? And he looked at me like he had died and gone to heaven, and he went in there and he fixed himself a drink. And he came back and he sat down, and nobody told me that it worked so fast. And I'm standing behind him, and he took a big swig of that. And the minute it hit his stomach, up he came. Man, he was throwing up all over everything. It scared me half to death. His face was turning red. He's throwing up all of my curtains, all over the coffee table, and I'm running behind him saying, Eddie, God, hold your head down. It just is everything. I followed him into the bathroom. We go down on our knees. His whole head, face, and everything starting to turn red. And my first thought was, he's going to die, and you're going to Big Mac. And I prayed to God, let him live. Man, please let him live, because I didn't want to go to Big Mac. Now, I go to work the next day. And I get to thinking again, if he did that 2 days in a row, he really would quit drinking. And so we have company the next night. And we go through this same thing. He told me to fix the drinks, and I didn't really want to, and he said, go fix them. So I went in there to fix them. The phone rang, and it was for me. And I go in there to answer that phone real quick. And while I'm fixing it, he finished up the drinks and brought them in. And when I go back in there, if I was sick because I knew that I had three people there and I didn't know which street was going to get it. And so anyway, he had taken the one that had the Epicac in it, fixed it for himself. And the other bottle he had fixed for Jacqueline and Johnny. And so when I go back in there, he took this great big drink, same routine, same pattern, everything exactly the way it was, except we had company. And I remember when he started throwing up, Jacqueline looked at me and she said, God, Chink, he's going to die. And I said, oh, I know it, I know it. And I'm back into the bathroom, rubbing his head, bathing his face, saying, God, let him live. I won't ever do it again. But I had to do it one more time, expecting different results, and I didn't get them. I want to share one other thing to you, with you, and that the stupid thing that I did. Besides filing for a divorce three times, which I would let it come nearly final, and then I'd call Eddie and say, let's talk. Because I knew that the man that I married was not that man that I was living with. There was something wrong there somewhere. I just didn't know what it was. But you know, I had done everything, and but still didn't want anything to do with God, but I thought prayer might not hurt. And so Eddie was home one night, and I decided that we're going to pray. And I say, pray for an alcoholic, or pray for a drunk, but don't pray with a drunk. Because that night I had this real brilliant idea. We're going to go in the bedroom, Eddie, tonight, and we're going to get down on our knees, and we're going to pray. And he looked at me like I was crazy. And he said, pray for what? I said, we're going to pray for you. Come on. Well, he's, like I said, he'll do anything I want to. He's so easygoing, so kind. And so he gets up and he wobbles into the bedroom with me, and we we go down and get out on our knees, you know. And we have our hands like this, and I'm watching him. And so he has his eyes shut, and he's all folded up there, you know. And I said, it was real quiet. And I looked at him and I said, Eddie, pray. And he said, pray for what? I said, pray that God makes you stop drinking. He said, I pray that God makes me stop drinking. And he just stood there. I said, Eddie, pray. I prayed. I said, but you don't know how to pray. Well, you tell me how to pray. And we had this conversation going back and forth, back and forth. And finally, I just said, hell, you don't know how to pray. And I got up and got out of there. And Eddie, after a while, he comes into the living room again. But we've talked about that, and Eddie says, I was just doing everything you told me to do. You tell me the words, and I was mouthing it. But I said, don't pray with a drunk, pray for a drunk. I've tried everything else there was to try to stop him from drinking, and nothing worked. Because I know today that they've got to have the desire to want to, and the willingness. And then on Sunday, it happened in our home. Eddie and I had been married, I guess, about 12, 13 years at that time. And Bobby was sitting on the divan watching TV, and Eddie was back in the recliner, not bothering anybody. And I had one of my tirades going, and I went in because, you know, poor me, I'm doing everything. I'm doing the washing, the ironing, the yard work, the whole bit. And y'all are sitting in here. And I'm standing in front of him, and I'm pointing my finger at him, and I'm telling him what a son of a bitch he is. And that little 12-year-old boy looked at me, and he said, Chink, my daddy's not sick. You're the sick one. God, that just tore my stomach out. Because Bobby had never said anything to me. We had gotten along, and everything was all right. And he looked at me, and he repeated, and he says, my daddy's all right. You're the sick one. And I ran into the bathroom, and I slammed that door shut. And I stood there in front of that mirror, and I looked at me, and I thought, what's wrong with you? Because you've always been a happy, go-lucky person. You're standing there with your hair down in your face. You don't care about anything anymore. You're screaming and hollering at everybody. What's wrong with you? And there was something in the back kept saying, AA. And I believe today, if there's some way they could find out, I think that I read that article in 1941 in the Saturday Evening Post by Jack Alexander, because I am a reader, I read all magazines, and my mother took the Saturday Evening Post. I think that's what it is, because I'd never been around him. I thought, Alcoholics Anonymous, it's supposed to help those that are drinking. And so I went into the living room, and I got on the phone, and I called out the Kelly Club. And when the man answered the phone, I said, I want you to send two men out to 1610 Carlisle Court. I've got a drunk and I want him sobered up. And this man said, honey, he said, does he want to get sober? I said, hell no, I want him to get sober. I said, I'm calling to get him sober. Will you send two men out? I'm telling him what to do. And he said, let me send an Al-Anon out to talk to you. And I said, an Al-Anon for what? And he said, well, you sound to me like you need Al-Anon. And I said, what is Al-Anon? And he said, well, that's for the non-drinker. And he said, I think that you would like it. It would help you. And I told him where he could go and what he could do. And I slammed that telephone down, and I went back into the bathroom and closed the door, and I started crying again and looking at me again. And when I got over my little crying spell, I thought, you know, you've tried everything else. Why don't you try Al-Anon? I didn't know what it was all about, and I really didn't want to, but I was desperate. And so I go back in there, and I dial that phone again. And the man answered the phone again, and I said, I have a friend that has a husband. And he said, honey, what's your address? And I told him, and he said, I'm going to send a lady out. And he said, I want you to visit with her. But just tell me that you will. And I said, all right, I will. And so about 11 o'clock that night, there was a lady came out to my house, and this kind of gets me because my life has gone so good. And today she has Alzheimer's. And her life went just the opposite from mine. And she needs all the prayers. She came out to my house that night, and we visited, and she told me about Al-Anon, and she said, I'll come get you tomorrow night, and we'll go to a meeting. And I said, I don't want to go to the meeting, Betty. I said, I'd rather just you tell me about it. And she said, no, you need the fellowship. So nothing would do her but for me to go. And so she came, got me, and we went to the Klassen Club. And at that time, it was in a big two-story home over on Klassen Boulevard. And we went in there, and there were about 12 women in there sitting in a circle. And I knew right off wasn't going to like it. Because I looked at all of them, and I thought, uh-huh, you've got yourself into one of these praying and healing things, and you are in serious trouble. And I sat there, and I told her, I said, Betty, when this thing's over with, we're going straight out of here. And so she said, will you just stay and listen? And so I looked around, and it seemed like that every time that I went to that meeting that I'd be sitting right in front of a slogan that said, but for the grace of God. And it took me a long time to realize that, but for the grace of God, I could have been that alcoholic. And the patience that he's had with me and the way that I've acted. And so I stayed at that meeting that night, and I looked at those slogans, and I looked up there at the steps, and I heard them say, it's a fatal illness. And I knew that I had to do something to save Eddie, because, I mean, I didn't want him to die. I did love him. But they told me that I wouldn't be the one that got him sober, that I had to turn loose. The hardest thing I've ever done in my life is release that alcoholic. The hardest thing I do today is release that alcoholic. But what a freedom, that I'm only responsible for my actions, and no longer am I responsible for Eddie. But I went to that meeting that night, and she come and got me the next night. And she come got me the next night, and she just kept coming and getting me. And I went to the Klassen Club for 6 months, but Eddie didn't get sober. I'd hurry home at night, and I'd shake him, and I'd tell him, I want you to hear what I've got to tell you. And he didn't care what I had. And it wasn't doing him any good, and it was taking my time, and I quit. And again, I thought, you know, I don't know that God even gives a darn about me. I really felt that way. And so they tell me, though, that it gets worse before it gets better, and you better believe that because it does. Eddie changed jobs. He became a deputy sheriff, head of communications for Oklahoma County, and he stayed with that job and retired from it. But Eddie and I really got into the throes of losing communication. Now, we're not talking. He's drinking on a daily basis, and things are getting bad and going from bad to worse. And this morning I get up and I decide that I'm going to go out to the hospital and I'm going to eat breakfast and leave him in the bed. I'm not getting him up anymore. I don't care if he loses his job. I had all these negative thoughts, and I mean, I was angry. And I got in my little car and went out to Baptist Hospital and park my car, and there was a man walked across in front of me, and it wasn't quite daylight. And at that time, the hospital was under construction, and we had to walk two blocks. And this man looked at me, and I looked at him, and I thought he was an employee. And he stood a lot taller and much heavier than my husband. And so I had my green coat on, and I pulled it up because it was north wind then, and I had to walk to the access road and then up. And I started towards this access road, and this man was ahead of me, and he had a stocking cap on his head. And I had my head down, and I was walking, and all of a sudden I had these 2 feet right in front of me, right on my toes, and a 38 in my stomach, and he had grabbed me right here. And I looked up at him, and I closed my eyes, and I said, God, help me. I get goose pimples when I think of it, because I had never in my life said, God, help me. It was always, God, get Eddie sober. God, do this, do that, do this. But this time I say, God, help me. I didn't call on anybody else. The one I didn't want anything to do with, I said, God, help me. And you know, I felt his presence. First time in my life I ever felt his presence. I knew he was there. And I opened my eyes and I looked at this man. He'd pulled his stocking cap down, over his face. And I looked at him and I said, don't harm me, because I haven't done anything to you. And I said, take my purse and my money, but I just don't hurt me. And he said, come on. And I said, no, I'm not going. You know, thank God for Al-Anon. Thank God for the slogans, because those things were going in my mind. And things that people had said were going in my mind. And I just kept talking in a calm voice. I wasn't cussing him out like I normally would have. I wasn't screaming or hollering. I could not believe that I was talking so calm to this man. And he said, come on. And I said, no, I'm not going. And I stood there, and a car came into the parking area, and the lights hit us. And when those lights hit us, the man shoved me back, and he started running down the south end of the parking area. And I realized then that God did for me what I couldn't do for myself, that he saved my life, that he was there. And I also realized at that minute that if I'd turn loose of Eddie, that he could save Eddie's life too, if I'd get out and quit playing God. Those thoughts hit me just like that. I said, I guess I'm one of the hard-headed kids of his, that he had to hit me over the head to let me understand that he is God and I'm not. But I reached down and picked up my purse and I started walking. And I was walking along there, and I told you that I went to this little church at home, and we'd I learned all these little memory verses and everything. And as I walked along there, you know what came into my mind? Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil, for thou art with me. And I started crying, and I got into the emergency room, and I told them what had happened. And so they called the police. They called Eddie, and I had to go through all of that down to the police station and everything. And I didn't want to pick out someone picture. I wasn't for sure. And I said, you know what I want to do is, y'all wouldn't understand, I want to go back to an Al-Anon meeting tonight. And I went home, and Eddie said, Chink, he said, that man would have killed you. And I said, he didn't. I said, Eddie, I asked God for help. He was there, and I know he was there. And I couldn't make Eddie believe that. He said, I'm going to follow you out of the hospital every day. He said, I'm with my gun. And that upset. I beg and plead with him, don't follow me, because I don't want any trouble, or you might get the wrong man, whatever, just go on to work and just leave me be. So that night I went to an Al-Anon meeting, and Eddie stayed home and he drank, and I felt different, because I knew that I was going to get something from this program. And I went to a meeting that night, and I heard a lady say 3 reasons I ought to be in an Al-Anon meeting. That's to help myself, to better understand the alcoholic, and to find a more spiritual way of living. And I was short in all areas. I knew then, that I was going to Al-Anon for me. I wasn't going to Al-Anon for Eddie anymore. But this program was for me, and that I was going to really try and make something out of it. And I've gotten so much from it. I learned that I could go to meetings, and then they invited me to go out and have pie and cake, and I didn't feel guilty when I did that, because we had some Al-Anon meetings at those pie and cake places in the restaurants. We'd sit there maybe 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and we'd talk Al-Anon. And I'd go home, and Eddie said, you know, he said, I'd try to stay alive until you got home, but he said it kept getting later and later. And he said, I'd have to have that drink, so he'd take a drink, and he'd be asleep when I'd get home. So I just decided then that if this is the way my life's going to be and I'm going to have to accept him the way he is, then I'm going to live. I'm going to enjoy my life. I started going to dances, and at that time we used to wear formals, and I had a bright red formal. And you can't ever depend on an alcoholic when they're drinking. You know, they're supposed to pass out 7. He decided to stay awake that night to 8. And, you know, and everything went wrong, and I'm in the bedroom in my formal, and I want to go to that dance. And so finally I thought, I'm going. So I just stepped out and walked into the hall, and when I did, Eddie looked up at me, and he said, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to go to the Kelly Club, to that Big Book Study Club, and then I'm going to stay for the dance. And he said, you won't have a good time. And I said, I'm going to try. And so I went to the Kelly Club that night, and we had the Big Book Study Club, and then when that was over, they had the dance. And I stayed for it, and I was sharing with Janet coming to down here this afternoon, this morning. I said, you know, I really showed what I was made of, because Eddie came down there about 11 o'clock, and he had been drinking. And, of course, I knew right then he wasn't working his program. He shouldn't be doing that, you know, and I'm taking his inventory and the whole bit. And so I get in my car and I go home. And Eddie stayed. And they all took care of him. And they all loved him. And I thought, he'll come home and he'll apologize to me. And so I waited up. And about 2 o'clock he came in. And, of course, what I do, run get in the bed so that he'll come wake me up and apologize to me. Now I want you to know that as of today, he has not apologized to me yet. You know, I learned to quit nagging at him. I learned that if I tell him once and he doesn't pay attention to him, if I tell him something twice, I'm nagging at him. And so I learned to accept him. And I've learned that he's had to accept me. And you know, things got better in our home because I learned how to release the alcoholic with love. And they told me to get a sponsor. And I guess that was one of the greatest things I ever did, because I got a sponsor that I still have today. And she has 3 months on me, and I thought she had so much wisdom. And I said, Winona, how did you get so smart? And she said, I wanted it worse than you did. And I guess that's true, because she worked so much harder. She's been such an inspiration to me, because she has come through cancer. She's come through the death of her husband. She's been an inspiration to me in all areas of my life, and she still enjoys life and lives one day at a time. We don't always get along. We get real hostile sometimes, talking, you know, and what makes me so mad is I'm the one that has to call and say I'm sorry or you were right or whatever. I learned how to treat that alcoholic as a child of God, to treat him with respect and to love him. One of the girls in my Al-Anon meeting told me one time, she said, Chink, said, when you are around Eddie, she said, even though he's been drinking, she said, lay a kiss on him every now and then, hug him, tell him that you love him. I don't want to do that, but if I've got to, I will. And so I go home, and Eddie's in this recliner, which was his regular place, and I go in that night, and I took a deep breath, and I go over to him, and I smacked him a good one, and I said, Eddie, I love you. And I walked in the kitchen, and I said, you sorry son of a bitch. And when I came out of the kitchen, he reached over and got a hold of my arm, and he said, Chink, I love you too. It just tore me up. Because I knew he had a threefold illness, and I knew that I was sick too, but I'm trying. And then you know what happened? I was at work one Sunday, one weekend, and Friday, it was on Friday, and the telephone rang, and it was Eddie. And he said, Chink, he said, I'm going to go with you to that open meeting tonight. And I just took it with a grain of salt. I said, it's fine with me, Eddie, if you want to, you know, go ahead. And so I never gave it another thought. And when I came home from work that afternoon, Eddie was dressed in a suit, and he was ready to go to the meeting. And I didn't know whether he was going to stay with me or not, but at 7 o'clock we left. And you know, they tell us, and I believe that God works in mysterious but good ways and for our benefit every time. And we go to the Keller Club that night, and there's about 300 people down there. And when we go into the, oh, and on the way down there, we were involved in a wreck. And that was the time during the hippies. One was driving, 1,000 of them came out, you know, around us. And by the time we got settled with the police and everything, we were about 15 minutes late getting down to the Kelly Club. And we walked into the back of the Kelly Club and sat down. And the man from the podium speaking that night was a man that I worked 15 years for in a wholesale jewelry business when I first moved to Oklahoma City. He was the only man that Eddie knew at the club that night. And I looked at him and I thought, I can't believe this. And Eddie leaned over and he said, honey, is that Leroy B? And I said, yes. He said, I didn't know he was an alcoholic. I said, I didn't either. Now, Eddie had told me that going down there, he said, I'm not going to sign anything. I'm not giving them my name. And we're going to get out of there just as soon as they say amen. I said, all right. And so when that meeting was over with, he took my hand and he said, let's go down and see Leroy. And I thought, God, you're working with me. We really are going to get him sober this time. We're going to get him sober. We didn't get him sober. We went down to the front, talked to Leroy, and Leroy King got Eddie that night, the next night, and took him to his first AA meeting, and later became his sponsor until his death a couple of years ago. Things got much better in our home. Eddie had not stopped drinking. He was, he said that he had so much respect for AA and he knew it would work, but he said the fear of death did not scare him as much as being without the bottle. And he said, I knew that I was killing myself, but I could not turn loose. And he'd go with me to open meetings on Friday night, and he'd never take a drink before he went. But I knew when we got home the pattern that he'd be drunk before 10 or 11 o'clock. And I felt guilty about that. And I told Eddie, I said, you know, honey, I said, you just go to one meeting a week. And I said, I go to 3 and 4 meetings a week. And I think you ought to go to more. And he looked at me and he said, some people are sicker than others. But like I said, you know, even though he was doing the best he could at that time, and I'm trying to do mine, we still would get into arguments because I had this nasty temper. I had to pray a lot about the anger to get rid of it. And today I don't have the anger. I don't. It's not worth my time to be angry. I can accept people and go and it doesn't bother me. My husband would, I knew that I had exhausted every avenue that I knew to try to get him sober. And I knew that it wasn't working, that I had to do something about me. Eddie and I, it was in February, I believe it was, and no, it was in January, and cold and icy, and I was trying to get Eddie to not drink that night, and he said, I've got to go get a bottle. And we got into words, and I said, Eddie, I'll go. And I went to the liquor store that night, and it was the first time I'd ever gone by to buy whiskey for him. But I got out in the snow and the ice and drove down to the liquor store and I bought 3/5 of liquor. And I brought it back and I set it down by the side of his chair. And at that time I was absolutely crazy and I said, I hope you drink yourself to death, you sorry son of a bitch. That's exactly what I called him. Eddie said, talking to some of the other people in AA, he said, I didn't know my name was Ed for 19 years. And I'm not proud of that, but you know, they tell me that when you give out physically, mentally, and spiritually, that, you know, you are deflated in depth, and I was. And I thought, you know, I'm going to accept him no matter what. I don't care how rough it gets, but I'm going to do this. And that night, about 2 o'clock in the morning, I heard him fall in the kitchen. I knew something bad had happened, and I asked God for strength. And I went in there, and I saw my first convulsion, and I called the ambulance. And they came and took Eddie to the hospital. And I want you to know that by the time I got out to the hospital, that he was sober, just sitting on that little gurney thing waiting for me to come in to chew me out, to get his clothes, and to go home. And I took him back home. I could not believe that he had come out of that quick. And when we got home, I said, you know, my stomach was turning. I was sick. I was exhausted. I went into the bedroom, and I got down on my knees, and I said, God, please help me. Help me to stay out of this man's life. Help me to quit trying to run the show. And I prayed with all my heart, body, and soul. And I got in the bed that night, and I want you to know that I went to sleep. And I slept the first night all the way through without looking or waking up to see if he's going after that drink about 2 o'clock in the morning. I got up the next morning. I couldn't explain it. I felt good. Like I said, he worked at the sheriff's office, and I had not planned any of this. And I went down to the sheriff's office, and I said, Mr. Turner, I said, I want to tell you that Eddie has a drinking problem. I'm totally exhausted. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I am through. And I hadn't made up my mind whether I wanted to leave, get out, or what. And he pulled out of his pocket a little AA 12 and 12 card. He said, Chink, I know more about AA than you do, honey. You go on back home, and I'll take care of it from here. I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't care. I got in the car, and I started home. And I cried all the way home. And I walked into the living room, and Eddie had gotten up to find me or something. He had was trying to get out of the chair. But he had fallen and cut his head right across there, and it was bleeding. The phone started ringing. It seemed like everything was just banging on me. And so I ran over there and picked up the phone, and I said, I can't talk. My husband's hurt himself. And it was the sheriff on the other end to see if I'd gotten home. I looked up, and an ambulance was backing up to my front door, and I hadn't called that ambulance. I looked up, and the police were walking in my house, and I hadn't called the police. And I thought, I know I've read it somewhere in that literature that people will come in and take over, and you won't be the one that gets that alcoholic sober. And I stepped back. And I thought, you know, you have shown me, and I've not been willing to turn loose. But I am turning loose no matter what. And Eddie called me names that he had never called me before, and I just stood there and looked at him because I knew he didn't know what he was saying. I knew that things were going to be right. He went to the hospital, and he stayed 33 days, and I want you to know that I stayed away from that hospital. It was tough, but I said, I'm not going around him. I've done enough damage. I'm going to get myself to some Al-Anon meetings. I'm going to go to conferences. I'm going to do anything I can in 33 days. And I called Betty, this lady that took me to my first Al-Anon meeting. And I said, let's go to the Apache, Oklahoma conference. Anybody know where Apache is? The little bitty spot right out in the middle of cotton field. I like not ever found it. Got one blinker light. We went through it. And turned around and come back. And I thought, I can't be having a conference here. And Eddie was in the hospital, and Betty and I went down there. And so I went into a cafe, and I said, are they having an AA conference here? And he said, yes, ma'am. He said, right across the street. Well, across the street was an old picture show. And I said, where? He said, an old picture show. Well, I went in there, and there must have been 200 people in there, and Wesley Parrish from Florida was talking. And I remember sitting down and listening to him, and I think he's the most spiritual AA speaker I have ever heard in my life. I love that man. And he said, you know, love is a spontaneous emotion. It has to come from within. And I love that. Because I didn't know what really the definition of love really was all about. You know, I'll do this for you, you do that for me, and that was love. And that's not the way it is. You know, I love you, and I don't expect anything in return. I just love you. So I went to that conference, and I came out feeling so good. And I went back home, and the next week, Eddie called me, and he said, Chink, he said, I can come home. So I went by, and I picked him up. It was like two strangers driving in a car, not knowing each other. We drove down Western, and finally he said, I don't know about you or what your plans are, And I said, I don't have any plans right now, Eddie. And he said, they tell me that if I'm going to stay sober, I'm going to have to go to Alcoholics Anonymous the rest of my life. It'll have to be first in my life. And I said, that's okay, because booze has been first in your life. And I'm still holding second. The lady plays electric steel guitar. I've lost third, but that's okay. Because, I mean, you know, whatever makes him happy, and yet we can go places together and do things together and yet release each other for freedom. We have a trust today that we never had before we got into this program. My husband is in service work, and he loves service work. Now, I go, and I have done service work, but I'm sitting back and letting others take part of it. I'm releasing that part, too. My life's busy, but we have time for each other. Eddie and I know how to communicate today. You know, when we were in the throes of alcoholism, when we communicated, we were both talking at the same time, just as hard as we could go. And I know today, when he tells me, he said, Chink, get a cup of coffee and a cigarette. I don't smoke. He'll say, get a cup of coffee and a cigarette. Let's sit on the front porch. We're going to talk. Sometimes I like what he says, and sometimes I don't. But we've got respect and courtesy for each other. When he's talking, I listen. And when I talk, he listens. And that's hard for me, because I'm one of those that wants to get right in there and tell him, you know. But it's so much different than what it used to be. Not too long ago, he's walking across the floor in the living room. He said, turn around early in the morning. He said, Chink, I just love you. And I said, Eddie, I love you too, but why did you tell me that this morning? You know, I got one eye, goes out this way, and my glasses are not on, no makeup, my hair's not combed, and just sitting there look pitiful. And he said, I love you because you don't fuss anymore. You don't get angry. And I said, I know it. I said, it amazes me too. And he said, but you don't have any reason to. And you know, I kept my mouth shut. But he has humor. He has a dry sense of humor. And we have a lot of fun in our home. And we have a little dog that, you know, we used to, we'd say, Lucille, go tell your daddy supper's ready. And little Lucille run in there and tell me that he didn't want any. And it was back and forth. And now we can talk, and the little dog goes with us, and everything's working out fine. I had to work on jealousy. When I married Eddie, I mean, he was mine. He's good looking. And I didn't want anybody around him, and I watched it. And I didn't want women around him, especially. And so today, I'm over my jealousy. I said, I love for AA and Al-Anon women to go up and hug and kiss my husband. By God, don't linger. I've learned that that jealousy's been removed, but it can come back. I'm grateful for my sponsor and my home group. I'm grateful for that alcoholic that I married, because I wouldn't know all of you nice people that I have met in this program. It means so much to me. I want to tell you one thing about an amend step that I made, and then I'll be through. But, you know, my mother and I did not get along, and I did not want anything to do with her for years. And my mother had a stroke, and she was at Norman, Oklahoma when it happened. And so the doctor had told me that to make plans for her funeral arrangements. And I was sitting there one night looking at her, and the thought came to me, you know, not one time did your mother ever tell you that you loved her. I mean, that she loved you. And the next thought came to my mind, and not one time did you ever put your arm around your mother and say, I love you. Now, I'm going to tell you something. I prayed for God to help me get up, because I didn't think I could get up out of that chair. And I found myself going over there to my mother, and I put my arm around her neck, and I said, Mother, I love you. And I'm sorry for being part of the problem that I've been in your life. But I want you to know that I love you. And you know, I know that she heard me. I had that feeling again that he was there. If you got any amends to make to anybody, don't hesitate, make them. You'll feel so much better. When I lost my mother and buried, there was a relief there, but I felt good. I want to leave y'all with one little prayer that I saw on a plaque. And that prayer said, God, teach me to life but don't ever let me forget how I once cried. I want to tell y'all I've enjoyed this so much. Y'all ever in Oklahoma City, y'all give me a call. Thank you.